where it's sharp, here's where it's safe. Here is the line, there is the toe. One quick motion, not that I know. Here is the scene, here is the blow. Here is the moment written in the book. Here is the actress, give her the part.
Hello and welcome to the Basement Shuffle. I'm Kevin, as always. And tonight, I'm joined by TJ Masters of the band Guma.
Hello.
All the way from Austin, Texas. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, so not only are you have your band Guma, but you're also a radio host.
Yeah, I got started as a volunteer at a nonprofit community radio station here in Austin. And it's actually the only cooperatively organized radio station in America, meaning that it's a cooperative where all of the members have voting rights, kind of like a food co-op. And the call signal is K-O-O-P, or as we say, co-op. And I started out as a volunteer there, and part of their mission is to teach the art of radio broadcasting. I had long wanted to have a kind of variety show, music show, phone calls, and whatnot. And they gave me the opportunity to get on the air about 5 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
Awesome, man. I guess I you could say I kind of had the same dream. Hence the podcast. So I've listened to two of your shows so far.
Excellent.
I plan to continue, mainly because it's a great show. It's a show that I want to listen to with Shazam on.
yeah, right on.
Because you're playing stuff that I've never heard before. And
yeah.
That's what I'm always looking for. Is good music that I've never heard before. Like, for instance, what did you play today? Sand is when I started.
Yeah, you like that sand track.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. Very laid back country rock. What you said it was from 76, I believe.
Yeah, that's their second record. I think the first one came out just a couple years prior.
Right on.
Just one of those, like, thousands of bands or artists out there that are just a blip on the radar and then disappear. I don't know that they did anything after that group or went on to become anything else. But you kind of hit the nail on the head about the show. Like, that the idea is discovery and exploration, and that's what drew me to, like, kind of like left of the dial community radio in the first place, is that you've got people who are passionate about music and passionate about art. And they have a platform for sharing. Not to mention terrestrial radio is just a kind of incredible, still magical to me, technology that we can beam information, data, and music out into the air. And I get a kick out of that as well. But yeah, I love playing kind of tunes that are also discoveries to myself from week to week. You know, I like doing kind of the crate digging for the show every week. And also, like, stumping Shazam. If I can come up with songs in the set that aren't even in that database, you know, or tunes that haven't made their way to Spotify or Apple Music just yet.
Yeah.
You know, I lean pretty heavily on music blogs to find stuff, which are still going in 2022, believe it or not. People are still posting music on blogs.
Yeah. It's a little farther in between, far and few. Than it used to be. What is that saying? Far and few between. Yeah. All right. Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. How you're doing your crate digging? I'm obviously you're not going through records in a dusty basement. but you're,
well,
you're,
you know, whatever gets the job done. Yeah, I come to it as a lover of music first. So wherever I can find the good stuff, as I'm sure you have a very similar outlook, you know, always searching for that rush or that high of, oh my gosh, what is this song?
Absolutely. Yeah.
The older you get, mm-hmm. the harder it is to get to that level, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And then you get people saying, oh, there's nothing good out there anymore. And it's like, dude, there's millions of songs and things that you've never heard of. You just got to look.
Totally.
Yeah. So speaking of crate digging, I was told that from Jason and John that you record your show at their record store, BLK Vinyl.
I do not record it there. I have performed it there, like live on location a few times.
Okay.
But no, every week I do it at the radio station. So the KOOP has a full radio suite of radio gear.
Right.
Studio, yeah. But we also have this remote on location type equipment. And so if you can get the details worked out, we do live on location type stuff from time to time.
Cool.
And that's fun. That's when we do like all vinyl shows and stuff like that from the record store.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'll have to hear that. Yeah, I meant to hear the one a couple of weeks ago. You did a South by Southwest showcase. Is that correct?
Yeah, the band played at the record store and then the broadcast was going to be live as well, which we should just say shout out to BLK Vinyl. I don't think we've said the name yet, but yeah. If you are local to Austin, Texas, one thing that I cannot do on nonprofit community radio is are what's called calls to action. So I can't compel people to go somewhere or buy something or vote for someone.
Okay.
And there are tricky kind of language tricks that you can use to get around when you're promoting something. You can't say that it's free because that might entice someone to come over, but you can say that it's open to the public, for example.
Okay.
What was I getting at? So, oh yeah. So shout out to BLK because I'm not allowed to say that on the air.
Yeah.
Great
finally,
record store.
You get to
I highly
say
recommend
it.
Stopping by if you're visiting Austin or if you live in Austin. John just has an incredible ear for music and for finding great records to put in the store.
Yeah, absolutely.
That broadcast, ironically, as I talk about all the great things about co-op, did not go off as planned. I had to bail on the on-location component and come back to the studio and do it. But that's what happens when you're doing live radio.
Yeah, well, just technical difficulties.
Yeah, we had some internet connection issues, so we couldn't get the signal back to the station.
Bummer. Well, how was the show?
Show was great, man. I'm playing in kind of a quartet configuration with cats from Austin, and they're all just kind of, we're just kind of getting geared up, I would say. The records, the most recent Guma records have been done out in Long Beach, California, with session players, jazz players. And so I would bring those recordings back to Austin and have to find a way to represent them live. And I've been working with these guys in town for probably about 3 years now. But of course, in the middle of those 3 years was 2 years of pandemic. So we were able to learn some tunes and rehearse and whatever, but we haven't really been able to start playing shows until just this year. And it's been awesome. The band is kind of really finding itself, I would say.
Very cool. What are we dealing with? Drums, guitar,
we got bass. Drums, bass. I'm on guitar and a guy playing the keys and occasional horns, trumpet and trombone.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah, that's cool. I always like to see like an orchestrated album, how someone would pull it off live with a stripped down band. I actually went and saw Andy Schaaf last night at Black Hat in DC.
Nice.
And that was a similar situation. It was what I think maybe, what was it, 1, 2, 3, 5 guys representing his music that usually has like horns on it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But very good show.
Yeah. I think my keyboard player has played with him
cool.
a couple of times. If only on like a South by Southwest kind of thing where people fly in and they'll put together a band of local musicians on the ground once they get there for their showcases or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, my buddy Mike St. Clair has played with Andy Schaaf.
Awesome. Shout out to Mike.
Yeah, shout out to Mike St. Clair.
Yeah. There's another guy that we know. Ryan Jewell was my last interview subject.
Yeah. So when you reached out to me about coming on the show, I looked you up, of course, and I listened to the most recent episode. I was delighted to discover that it was Ryan, who is a pretty crucial component of a few of the tunes on this most recent Guma record.
Awesome.
Yeah. Great drummer.
Yeah, I found him. Well, you probably know from listening to the episode. I found him, saw him with Riley Walker, and then I reached out for a lesson or two. And yeah, he's a very interesting guy. And yeah, I just found out recently that he was on your record, and it was a pleasant surprise. You've got another one of my favorite drummers on there, Chad Taylor from Chicago
Chad Taylor.
Underground Quartet Trio Duo.
Yeah.
Fantastic drummer. Yeah, you've got some great players on there, dude.
It's a little bit of an all-star cast, which is what they're known for doing out there at Big Ego Studios. They've got a real close-knit community that they've built out in Long Beach over the past, well, Chris Schlarb has been recording for decades, but Big Ego has been a location since 2016 or 2015, I believe.
Okay.
And yeah, they've got everybody from the Chad Taylors of the world coming through to people like me who are relatively underground or unknown, just looking to make quality art, more or less.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. Yeah, and it's got a nice sound. When I ordered your record, they sent me
What else did they send you?
Sent me a couple of goodies. They sent me a 7-inch of it's more of a single of, who the hell is this? I think this is Schlarb's band.
That's Psychic Temple. I have that record as well.
Yeah, what is it? Two songs about cults, I think it's called. And he's doing
That's a nice surprise, because that's an earlier single, and you never know when those kinds of things are going to go out of print, and you become a fan and you're like, oh, if only I was a fan a year ago, I might have got one of those.
That happens to me all the time. So he's doing SOS, I've Got to Run, and on the backside he's doing Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears.
Yeah, that Tears for Fears cover.
Both excellent productions. And then they sent along this album. Jeremiah Lloyd Harmon, and the album is called Namesake. And I listened to that a little bit today, and that studio definitely has a sound. It's a good sound.
Yeah.
You can tell. Yeah. I can tell by the drums. The drums have a certain sound to it, and it's excellent, man.
You know what's funny? I've learned a lot about recording drums from going out there to make records, and they don't ever put more than 3 or 4 mics on the drums, and I think that's a very smart and kind of big picture way to do it, especially in this day and age where you've got computer capable of taking 192 tracks simultaneously at 192 kilohertz or whatever.
Yeah.
To be bold enough to just put 3 mics on the drums and decide at that stage of the recording process, this is what we're going to have to work with, I think definitely sets a standard and a precedent and a sound just like you described.
Yeah.
And it's a good one. It's a good sound.
Yeah. And it definitely shows that he knows what he's doing. He's brave enough to do that. But it also allows for more people in the studio when there's not a bunch of microphone stands, you know, crowding the space.
Absolutely.
How much of the record, a list of sightings, did you do live?
Essentially all of it. There are the woodwinds that you hear, and some of the solos are overdubs. My vocals were done back here in Austin. I got into kind of a economical way of working, because it can get quite expensive when you're working with a bunch of different people. Where I would go out to Long Beach and we would cut rhythm tracks, and then I would bring the stuff back here. And I'm an erstwhile recording engineer. Most of my technical ability is in live sound engineering, which I've been doing since I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. But I would bring stuff back here and work on the vocals and kind of the nitty gritty and the boring stuff at home and then go back out there. But I am really proud to say that, you know, if you're hearing anything with like drums, bass, guitar, piano on it, it was cut with four people or more in the same room playing at the same time. No headphones, no click tracks,
just live.
Kind of learning the live.
That's great.
And kind of learning the song on the spot, you know, not really any time for rehearsals ahead of the studio date.
Oh, no shit. So like on average, how many takes would it be for a song?
I would say you start working up a song and you run it maybe five or six times before it starts to feel like, okay, we got something going here. Let's start rolling. And, you know, certainly no more than 10 takes, probably no fewer than five.
Wow.
It's pretty rare, especially when you're not doing rehearsals. And some of these people I would be meeting for the first time, like the day of the tracking.
Yeah.
It would be pretty rare and pretty radical to get like a first take or a second take and have that be the one. But right. The other side of that equation is you don't want to run the song into the ground. You want it to have this kind of
immediacy,
feeling that it's being born. Yeah, this kind of nascent artistry that feels fresh, but at the same time assured and confident and somewhere in between 5 and 10 takes is that magic spot where everybody is like really loving it. They've figured out all the twists and turns, which if any of your listeners haven't checked out my records yet, I hope they will after this episode. There's a lot of twists and turns in my music. I kind of can't sit still as a songwriter. So there's a lot of little tricky parts that are not necessarily like sharp, like it's not prog or math rock, but it's just time signature changes, key changes.
Yeah.
Kind of trying to pull one over on the audience, and musicians, professional musicians love that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how rewarding it is to bring my own compositions into the studio and then have people who play music all day, every day, just loving it. And being like, this is so much fun. You know? It makes it, you can hear it in the music, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, man. It's a very lively record. I like it very much. That's got to feel good, man. Like, you know, especially like somebody that you look up to.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're like, man, this is fun. You wrote this?
Yeah.
That's cool. That's cool. So how do you, do you have a process as far as your writing? Are you using like a drum machine? Are you a word guy first? Well, go ahead.
You know, songs are so funny. People write songs all the time without even realizing it. You know, whether you're parodying something that you heard on the radio or parroting something that you hear on the TV, especially musicians, or I can speak for myself only, maybe sounds, I gravitate towards sounds and kind of unconsciously mimic sounds, you know, without even thinking about it. If there's a little like jingle on the TV, I will like call and response with the jingle without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
And so people, songwriters and not songwriters, do that kind of stuff all the time without even realizing it. As far as a process for writing songs goes, I've done it in so many different ways over the years. From when I was first starting out and kind of trying to make demos that sounded like records. So you're at home playing all the instruments yourself and sweating all of the tiny details and going, oh, why doesn't this sound like it sounds on this record that I love? Like, what am I doing wrong? Mm-hmm. So I have whole albums where I've kind of built a song piece by piece. And then on the other side of the equation, you've got like the most recent Guma stuff where I've kind of learned from going out to Long Beach a very nice middle ground where you don't overcompose and you leave space for the professionals to kind of come in and do what they're really good at without dictating too much. And so lately, and by lately, I guess I mean the past 6 years or so, My songwriting has become much more small, I guess. I don't really enjoy doing all of the demoing the way I used to, like building drum tracks and plugging in fake strings and all this kind of stuff. It's not really that fun anymore for me.
Well, it takes you out of performing. Now you're programming, and that's totally not as fun. Yeah. But yeah, that's cool. So you're at a point now where you can go into a studio and, like you said, let the guys take over and do what they do.
Yeah.
Just give them the space to do that. Yeah, man. Fantastic.
It takes me a long time though, like while we're still on this, because songwriting is a topic that is like very near and dear to my heart, but I don't think people don't really talk about it that much or write books about it. And so just thinking about, because everybody does it differently too, that is what's so fascinating about it. And for me, it takes a really long time to get songs together. Going from like scraps of language that I picked up from watching movies or listening to the radio or passing conversations, you know, that kind of stuff ends up in a notebook somewhere. Sometimes lyrics come out fully formed, you know, like a whole stanza just kind of falls out and you're like, whoa, that was really cool. How can I make that happen again?
Yeah, right.
It's almost like, and I've heard people put it this way before, it's almost like every song feels like it's the last song you're ever going to write, because there is a component of it that is like, I don't really know how I did that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I don't really know where this idea came from. You know, it's probably the result of a bunch of different little ideas that I wasn't really paying attention to that were just kind of like accumulating in the background. And then when I sat down to do something, they came out. But it takes me a long time. I get really, I'm pretty picky about lyrics. I don't really have a lot of patience for bad lyrics. And so I'm kind of critical of myself in that regard. And then just, like I said, putting all the right kind of twists and turns into each song and making it interesting. I think one thing that I really am proud of about A List of Sightings is that there's no two tunes that sound like they belong together. Like you couldn't pick two songs and put them on a 7-inch A side, B side, because you'd have to do that with every song. Like they're all kind of their own little animal.
Yeah.
Which I really like to do.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I it's a great album. I hear a couple of influences in there, and correct me if I'm wrong, I hear a little Jerry Garcia. I hear David Byrne. What else was there? I forget. But yeah, that one, what's the song that you do the duet with
Song for a New Painting. The song that we're talking about is kind of a carbon copy of this style of Brazilian music from the 70s that is just like very groovy, very smooth and airy, but funky, I guess.
Yeah.
There was a genre in Brazil, still is a genre in Brazil, like what they call top 40, or what we would call top 40, they call MPB, which is Música Popular de Brazil.
Okay.
But it's like the whole genre, like discs are labeled as MPB record. And so, of course, across decades, whatever that means is going to change. But at least in the 70s, they, like Tropicália had already landed on the scene. Bossa Nova had already landed on the scene. Of course, the classic Brazilian forms like the samba and this kind of thing. But in the 70s, they started getting more American influences. They were picking up radio transmissions from the United States and stuff like James Brown was coming into Brazil. And so 70s MPB, or popular Brazilian music, has some of the, to my ear, most satisfying, like in the pocket grooves with just the luscious instrumentation that you can imagine. Guitar, strings, electric piano, like it's all there on that Guma track, because I love it so much. I wanted to like really pay tribute to that era of Brazilian music.
Yeah, well done. Is that Tropicália? Is that from Brazil?
Yeah. That's like late 60s is when that kind of hit the scene.
Okay. Right on. And then that morphed into MPB?
Yeah. Well, the Brazil, to their credit, is very proud of the not just the indigenous rhythms and melodies that have come out of that part of the world, but they're proud of their popular cultural touchstones as well. And so the opportunity to take Tropicália, which is kind of like psych rock meets bossa nova, and take bossa nova and take samba and take jazz and put the Brazilian spin on it, and then they stand behind it like 100%. And I just love that confidence and that love of their own music. I think it's really inspiring.
Yeah, man. Fantastic. I have to ask you, and you may not answer me, but what's up with that guitar solo on House Analog? How'd you do that?
Oh, yeah. We can talk about that. That's like my Adrian Belew moment.
Yeah, it's awesome. What'd you do? What'd you have your guitar going through?
It's not in the same room as I am right now. I have it was just going through one pedal, and I'm not really a pedals guy. You can hear it on the Guma records. Like, I love clean electric guitar. That's pretty much all there is. If it's not acoustic guitar, it's just like clean, sparkly electric guitar. And but I put it through this pedal that I have called Count to Five, which is made by a guy called Montreal Assembly, or he goes, his business is called Montreal Assembly.
Interesting.
And it's kind of a combination of a delay and a tape loop. So you can delay the guitar signal, but then also pitch shift it continuously. Like if you're pitch shifting a tape, you know, it doesn't step up like the notes on the scale. If you run a tape faster, it's at a higher pitch. If you slow it down, it's at a lower pitch. And that's just like continuous pitch shifting. And this pedal can do that. And I mean, it does all sorts of things, but I think in that moment on that song, I was using the looping functionality and then the pitch shifter to do these weird arpeggios that are not really arpeggios, but it kind of sounds like a dial-up modem to my ear.
Yeah, it's cool. When I first heard it, I thought it was just bare guitar. Like, maybe it's treated. Maybe you're kind of tapping it with like a screwdriver or something on the fretboard. But no, the more I listen to it, it's like, no, there's something far more interesting going on there. And it is, man. I've never heard of that company. I've never heard of that pedal. I'm definitely going to check it out after this. Dude. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I'll take that pedal and sometimes run like vocals through it, because you can get some really wild harmonies out of the pitch shifting capabilities. It's a digital pedal, but there's something about the way that it shifts the pitch that is very agreeable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where can I hear something like that, where you run your vocals through it?
Good question. There's stuff on the first Guma record, which has a gray cover from 2016. And it's kind of buried in the mix. You know, for my money, with recording stuff, you never want to be too forward with your sonic trickery.
Mm-hmm.
I always try to kind of like bury that stuff in the mix. Because if you're too forward with that kind of stuff, it almost immediately sounds dated.
Yeah,
like I've made records where a year later you go back and listen to it and you're like, why did we choose that goofy synthesizer sound? Oh man, it sounded so cool at the moment.
Yeah.
And this pedal kind of creates these magical things that at the moment you're like, whoa, that's amazing. That could be a whole song. But if you can contain yourself and push that stuff to the back, you end up with a much more balanced end result. And it's also kind of serves the function of being an Easter egg, or I don't know, man. Like as a lover of music albums, and I'm sure you feel the same way, like you go back and you listen to your favorite things, and still there are components of the mix that you will identify for the very first time 20 years after you first heard it. And that can be just as thrilling as discovering the new gem when you're crate digging, is hearing something new in a favorite song and going, oh my God, oh my God, I never heard that before.
Yeah.
And when I first started writing songs, when I was a teenager, I used to think that all that little stuff was like planned and calculated, and like the geniuses behind the mixing board were just like pointillists painting with tiny little dots, you know, and placing these things. And when I first started making music and demoing in the way that I described earlier, I was always trying so hard to fill all these little spaces with little ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really could figure out why my songs sounded cluttered, even though I was very deliberately cluttering them.
Yeah.
And it's only with age and a little bit of retrospective wisdom that I've realized that like most of the greatest parts of records, or the parts that you love the most, are like happy accidents in the studio.
Yeah.
That weren't really planned for. And so, similar to composing with kind of more open mind or open page to allow other musicians to fill in, if you record with the same kind of mindset, you open yourself up to these little gems just appearing on the spot. And it can be a little bit, it can be more than a little bit terrifying to go into the studio with just a sheet of paper with some words and chords on it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you let yourself experience that fear and kind of roll with it, then, and get to the other side of it, then you are in the best position for the kind of beautiful, happy accidents that make great records great records.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah, it's almost a benefit to not have something fleshed out and let stuff like that happen. But yeah.
We're talking on a very auspicious evening for me, because tomorrow I'm going into a studio here in Austin to start wrapping up the follow-up to List of Sightings.
Awesome.
Which I recorded here in Austin with Austin musicians with the same kind of mindset we've been talking about, you know, trying to build tunes that aren't too overwrought and let people who are really good at what they do shine.
Yeah.
I kind of took a lot of the knowledge that I picked up in Long Beach from the past two Guma records and brought it back to Austin. And thankfully it worked this time. you never know when you're going into that studio if it's going to work or not. Uh-huh. Thankfully it did. And so we're mixing that record tomorrow, which is pretty exciting. And it makes me appear very prolific to have released an album last month and be mixing the follow-up
right
tomorrow. But in fact, you know, this is another case where like these songs took years to come together, and it kind of snowballs as you get closer to the culmination of a project. Like it might take 2 years to write an album and 2 days to record it.
Right. You well, know? When did you finish List of Sightings?
We finished it in July 2021, so just months ago, 8 or 9 months ago.
Cool, man.
But we started it in 2019, and I flew out there in December of 2019. It was like the last thing I did that year in that decade, mm-hmm. was cut all of those tunes, the rhythm section, so like drums, bass, guitar, piano. And then I had planned to go back just 2 months later and finish it in February 2020. And so I spent January cutting all my vocals and stuff like that. Adrian Ballou guitar solo here in Austin. Mm-hmm. And then those dates got canceled because of the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of just sat on it for a year and a half. It took all the way until July 2021 to come back to it and wrap it up, which I've never done before.
Yeah. So okay, so
and it was kind of great.
You've probably been sitting on this last batch of songs for a little bit.
Well, I think most of them probably came up in the last couple of years, like during the pandemic. I wasn't doing a lot of producing and writing in 2020 or 2021, but they're all relatively new, and it was only like just when stuff kind of started to relax in the second half of last year, we took them to the studio and did the same thing we do out in Long Beach, which is just try to cut rhythm sections quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this one went a bit quicker, huh? This record.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our first tracking date was mid-November last year, and here we are on April 1st, just about, and it's going to be done. So awesome. That's like 5 months. That's probably the fastest I've ever taken to do a record.
And you did it all in Austin.
Yeah, all in Austin with great Austin players. And it's going to be different than any of the other three. What can I say?
What studio did you go to?
Place in town called Estuary. And it is built in the back of an old craftsman house, the likes of which are all over Austin, Texas, or are slowly being replaced by expensive new home construction. But there's still a lot of cute little houses out here. And it's got a studio built on the back end of it. And it was actually owned by Bruce Robeson and Kelly Willis. I don't know if you know those names. They're kind of
sounds familiar.
Nashville slash Texas country folks. Mm-hmm. I think Bruce Robeson lives out in the country now. But yeah, that was his studio, is my understanding, or he built it.
Oh, fantastic. I might be thinking of Paul Robeson because I'm growing Paul Robeson tomatoes.
Oh.
But
got some tomato plants in the greenhouse.
Oh, yeah? You're a gardener.
Yeah, well, I try to be.
This is my second attempt.
Yeah. So I've been out in the house that we live in now for, I guess, 3 years now. And it's the first place that we have ever owned and have a little bit of space. And it's outside of Austin. I live about half an hour outside of the city. Mm-hmm. So I've tried gardening the last 3 years and not succeeded very well, but I've learned something every time. And hopefully this year that knowledge accumulates enough to where we actually get some good results.
Yeah. Like I said, this is my second attempt. I tried last summer last year to do tomatoes and did not go well. I started them too late and it just, I grew them all like too close together and stuff. And so I tried to transplant them and this year is going to be better, man. I'm telling you, TJ, these tomatoes are going to taste great.
I find that I just have a lot of questions about gardening where it doesn't seem like there's a good place to find an answer.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I need to spend more time in a library, but like I've learned so many different types of things, on YouTube and gardening, like it's not as easy to look up gardening stuff on YouTube as it is to look up like how to replace the toilet, you know?
Yeah.
I find that I have like soil composition questions that are not easily answered.
Huh. Like how much nitrogen should be in the soil?
Exactly.
Stuff like that. Oh man. Let me know when you find out. Speaking of nitrogen and soil and planting and stuff like that, the cover of A List of Sightings, who's that little guy with you? There's a chicken that you're holding.
Yeah, that's Buffy. She's my little girl, and she's one of how many hens do we have right now? I think 11. We have 11 hens. She is a bantam-sized hen, which means that she's like half the size of a normal chicken. So she's full grown, but she kind of looks like a little dove.
Yeah,
there on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And the chickens, also a somewhat recent hobby along with the gardening, since we have the space for it. And in the last couple of years, I've raised some hens from like day old hatchlings.
Yeah.
And you know, on you, because you spend, you're like this towering giant over their special little brooder, their little like playpen before they're big enough to go outside. And so naturally they imprint on you. And so now they're all adults, but when I go outside, they kind of like, they hear me come out the door and they run around the corner. They're expecting me. And some of them are friendlier than others, but what I'm getting at is that of all of them, the one that's on the cover of that record is the one that kind of will like instantly hop up into my hand without even like, I don't need to bring any treats. I don't, you know, she just kind of like gets up in my arms, which is really adorable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's your buddy. But yeah, speaking of this cover, man, it's just beautifully laid out. What are these?
Oh, thank you.
What are these gold etchings or illustrations? Like you've got a round, a medallion on the front, and then you've got a square in the fold.
Yeah, and then there's some on the labels themselves as well.
Oh, yeah.
I think the labels on the disc itself turned out really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, shout out to Stephen Rockwood, who is a very talented designer and a longtime friend of mine, albums for me in the past. But we had kind of drifted apart over the past few years. And this project was something that brought us back together. I reached out to him and asked if he was interested in doing the work. And he just knocked it out of the park. I'm so glad to hear you say that you like it, because I think it really is in person when you've got that like 12 by 12 gatefold and like the printing, the matte printing, it's just a very beautiful jacket. Yeah. But those emblems, those came from a book that I have scanned to my computer. I think I found it on the Internet Archive or some, you know, one of those websites that has open source high resolution images. And it is a handbook of architectural ornamentation. So it's some few hundred pages of hand drawings of different styles of architectural ornamentation. So everything from like columns to gargoyles to tiling.
Yeah.
And all of those like very, I guess, bread and butter kind of architectural components, there was a whole series of plates of animals. And I knew that the record was self-titled for the longest time. I was trying to do a trilogy of Guma records that were just called Guma. And then what I learned after doing the second one was that it just makes it like so unsearchable when people are like, oh, what's your music called? Where can I find it? Yeah. Like, well, it's called Guma. And then they type that into something like Spotify, and Spotify thinks they're misspelling something like Gummo or Gummy, and yeah, it just serves up a bunch of other bullshit. And so I had written the closer on that record, which is called List of Sightings. And that tune was about when we first moved out to this house, which is somewhat in the country, I was seeing all this wildlife that I had never seen before. Certainly not when I lived in New York City. And then when we lived in Central Austin, I was not seeing things like snakes and coyotes and birds and scorpions and toads. And the list goes on and on and on. And so my wife and I were kind of keeping a list of sightings. You know, what did you see today? Mm-hmm. And so it was still a self-titled Guma record until we got to the mixing phase. And Chris Schlarb kind of put some heat on me, like, so you're going to just like hide behind your unsearchability forever, or are you going to try to sell some records? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know that of all the song titles, I hate coming up with names, by the way. I should just say that. I hate titles and I hate band names, and it's just such a pain in the ass. But of all the song titles, List of Sightings felt like the most appropriate. And then there was this nice confluence of the animal imagery that I was finding in this book that speaks very directly to the original list of animals that I was keeping. And so it all kind of came together in a very conceptually satisfying way, at least for my end. I hope it's satisfying for people who pick up the album and listen to the music and look at the images and touch it. But for me as the mastermind or whatever, rarely do you attain this kind of like full conceptual interlocking, like the Rubik's Cube comes together or whatever at the last minute. And you're like, oh man, this actually does feel like an object.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a lark, or it's not just a game that we're playing.
Yeah. That's cool. I like the explanation of that, because the title, A List of Sightings, is intriguing. Aliens come to mind when I look at it. I'm like, oh, you must be talking about like UFOs or something like that. But yeah, to find out that it was a list that you and your wife are keeping of different critters that you were seeing in the wild. That's awesome. And yeah, and then it all ties together with the artwork. Fantastic, man. So you hate coming up with band names. So do I. I hate titles and band names. What made you decide on Guma?
A friend said, that'd be a great band name. And I said, great, I'll take it.
Does it mean anything?
No, it doesn't mean anything. But I used to live in Queens, New York, and I was a bicyclist in the sense that I would ride my bike everywhere to work, to social engagements, what have you. New York is an imminently bikeable city, and I would recommend it to anyone who lives there. If you don't have a bike, get one and start riding it. It's terrifying. It's kind of like being on a roller coaster.
Yeah.
But I feel like the drivers in New York are actually more respectful of bikers than in other places that I've lived in the country, because yeah, they're so used to driving in this kind of crazy maze that is New York City and leaving space for people who are on bicycles. Which is not to say that it's not dangerous. You should acquire appropriate safety equipment as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, it's a great way to see a city and to learn a city. A lot of people live in the same place all their lives and they don't really know how to get from A to B. It's kind of remarkable whenever I'm in the car with somebody and they're like, they've lived in this city for 5 years and they have to like Google map us to get to downtown or whatever. I'm like, you don't know how to drive to downtown? Like, what's yeah, going on?
Yeah.
But I would ride my bike around New York, and there were always these construction dumpsters for apartments or brownstones or buildings that were being renovated or torn down or whatever. And it seemed like there were more of them in Queens and Brooklyn that had this painted on them, but I would always see these green dumpsters with Guma painted on them in yellow paint, like very sloppily hand painted G-U-M-A, Guma.
Uh-huh.
And then just like a phone number, 71A, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, there's really no mystery there. It's obviously some kind of construction carting company, waste carting company. But I always thought that they were kind of mysterious because there was no address. There were no names. It was just like Guma and a phone number.
Yeah, handwritten or hand painted. Yeah.
Yeah. No, like no logo even, right? It's just hand painted. and I think I was standing outside of a venue with one of my former bandmates, and we were either seeing a show or we had just played a show, and just standing on the corner in the middle of the city, and there was one of those dumpsters across the street, and he said, that'd be a cool band name. And I said, all right, I'll take it.
Yeah. Why not? It works, dude. Yeah. I noticed, you've borrowed the design from Goya for your t-shirt design.
Yeah, I have some bootleg Goya t-shirts.
Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, you know, four letters, starts with G. Why not?
And that's a pretty iconic logo too. Like they've got a great font, that Goya.
Yeah, yeah. I always like that. I mean, you know, I used to skateboard when I was a kid and stuff, and, you know, they would always borrow different designs. Designs, yeah.
Totally.
So
I'm wearing a bootleg Grateful Dead shirt right now. Speaking of Jerry Garcia, it's like kind of the Steal Your Face logo, but it's a little bit off.
Can I see it? Your mic is kind of in the way. Yeah, it's a little. Yeah, that's definitely like a hand-drawn Steal Your Face, but it's got a hand coming out of the head smoking a joint.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then some weed leaves
there
on either side. Fantastic. Where did you get that?
That was a Christmas gift. And I believe, what's the guy's name? Warren Spiral. I believe that he was tapped, or they, or she, I'm not sure. I think it's a guy. They were tapped for like official Dead merchandise in the past year or so. Like they started out making bootleg Dead shirts and then got tapped to do like an actual one, which is pretty funny.
Oh, that's cool, man. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the cool thing about the Dead is that, you know, they would do stuff like that. Like they would let the tapers, you know, tape their shows and stuff.
Yeah,
like
let
that.
The tapers tape.
Yeah, and then, you know, they'll years down the road they'll let a bootleg shirt guy become official, you know?
Yeah, right. It's like you've become gilded.
Yeah.
You're part of the canon.
Yeah, you've been absolutely. You've been blessed by Bob Weir, I guess. But
are you a Dead fan?
I am. I mean, I'm not the guy that listens to, you know, live tapes or anything. I actually like their studio albums.
Yeah, me too.
I probably know more than I should because I listened. I have a Sirius XM radio, and I would listen. I went through a period where I would listen to the Grateful Dead channel, and I can't listen to it anymore. But yeah, it's good stuff, man. It's just an amalgamation of American music, you know, distilled through one band. It's pretty cool, man.
Totally, totally. I love that probably one of the most recorded bands in the history of recording. And I love that you can, however deep you want to go with them, you can follow their development in this kind of granular way. And there's also something really inspiring about their willingness to let people tape, release the tapes. You know, you might put on a live tape and the band just sounds like garbage. Like they're just playing miserably that night. Mm-hmm. They're not locked in. None of the solos are really hitting it off. And then you listen to a show from the next night and it's just like the greatest American band you've ever heard.
Yeah.
And to me, there's something really inspiring about being allowed to hear people at their less than perfect moment.
Yeah.
Kind of icons of American music or like your heroes or whatever. They can have an off day too.
Yeah, they really kind of tried to blur the line between audience and entertainer.
Yeah.
Which was pretty cool, man. They weren't untouchable.
Right.
But that is pretty interesting that you can pretty much just hear them develop into what they finally became. I mean, everything was taped, man. Like, you can hear it all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. There was a time in my life where I wanted to listen to nothing else. And still, if I'm kind of like short-circuited of like, what do I want to listen to while I'm like cleaning the kitchen or whatever, and it's like too difficult to make a decision, mm-hmm. I will always kind of tend toward them because there's so much. You'll never hear it all. And I've learned so much from listening to that group, for sure.
Have you ever seen them?
I have. Well, I saw Dead and Company, I think is what they were going under at the time, in 2016. And John Mayer was playing the part of Jerry.
Yep.
And, you know, that's a tricky one because most people who like music like the Grateful Dead do not like music like John Mayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought it was kind of surreal that he admitted in an interview like, oh yeah, like I only just recently got into them, like 2014, 2015, and was like, wow, this is really great music. And then they asked me to join the band, you know, like
weird.
He jammed out with Phil Lesh a few times and then was like, yeah, you should join up.
No shit. That's weird.
I was kind of like, man, you couldn't find somebody that has a little more of like a history with you guys.
Yeah, right. Makes no sense.
But you know, that being said, I will say John Mayer is a phenomenal guitarist.
Absolutely.
You can't put one over on his guitar playing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a single song of his that I appreciate, but the dude can play the guitar.
Hell yeah, man. He's got some great guitar faces too when he's playing. but you never saw the proper Dead with Jerry? And
no.
Yeah.
No.
I got to see him in 94, I believe.
Wow.
Somebody just gave me tickets. It was Dylan and the Dead. And
oh wow.
Another situation like we talked about earlier where it was like, oh man, I wish I were more into this back then. Like, yeah. I didn't really know, you know, I might have had a Bob Dylan record or something, but I was like in high school, I was like, I don't know, might not even been 16 years old yet. And I was probably, you know, stumbling around trying to look for weed or something instead of paying attention to the music, you know, because I mean, shit, I probably missed Space and, what is it? Space and,
drums.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If I could go back in time and see that show again, I'd be blown away.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, that was actually a really special occasion. My wife and I had left New York and we were moving to Austin, and I went ahead and I booked some solo shows along the way, and we kind of took our time driving down to Texas, dropped off a bunch of our stuff, and continued driving all the way out to California, and I was playing shows all the way out to LA. And when we got to Grand Canyon, saw the Grand Canyon for the first time, and we were camping there, I was looking on Instagram, and a friend of mine was on the crew for Dead & Company. He was doing like second monitor engineer or something, A2. Mm-hmm. And I'm like looking at his Instagram posts, and we're in Northern Arizona, going to be in California in a couple of days. He's in Oregon, going to be in California in a couple of days. And I was like, oh my gosh, I got to text him right now and see if we're going to be in the same place on the same day. And lo and behold, he was like, I think it was in Chula Vista, which is south of San Diego. And so I was playing in LA. So we made the drive down to Chula Vista, and we got like crew passes or laminates or whatever. And he took us backstage. And so we saw the band from side stage from the monitor position.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. You get to meet anybody? Like in the band?
Not in the band. I met a few of the crew members. I think my buddy was not like a big Dead fan. It was just another job for him.
It was a gig, yeah.
The sound engineers, you know, kind of go from gig to gig, or they have their regular groups they work with. And I think he was just very briefly joining them that summer. So he wasn't hugely into the band, and was also not in a position to like really interact with the band that much.
Yeah.
Which is pretty surreal when you think about it. Like, your crew gets so big to where it's at the point where you have employees that you don't even speak to, really. They're just like there to help the show go off.
Yeah.
But it was cool. Nonetheless, it was very cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, the stars aligned that night, man. Good for you. So you were just talking about you were playing shows across the States. Is there a plan for a tour?
Not at the moment. So many plans have been destroyed in the past few years. I think everybody's got like planning anxiety about it. Mm-hmm. I have always been and continue to be pretty independent, in the sense that I don't have a manager. I don't have a business manager. I don't have a booking agent. Mm-hmm. I think I would like to have all those things. But at the same time, when you get pulled into that world, it becomes this kind of like machine that needs to be constantly lubricated by money. Mm-hmm. And that is like the antithesis to having a good time, much less making good art. And so all that is to say is that if a show goes off, whether it's here in Austin or it's somewhere else, it's probably a good chance that I have planned and booked it myself. And so at this point, thinking about a tour, it feels a little bit premature. I would love to get these songs on the road, man. I would love to get this band on the road.
Yeah.
I've been in bands in the past, and when you tour, you become a like completely different animal, and your songs change. Some things stay the same, but a lot of things change. Mm-hmm. You become tighter. You get like your tour chops from playing night after night after night. And none of the Guma material has ever really had the chance to be run through that ringer. And as a huge fan of the Dead, as we've just been talking about, and as somebody who puts a lot of improvisational elements and spontaneous elements into the music, I want nothing more than to have the opportunity to play this stuff night after night and change the way we solo over it, talk to each other over it.
Yeah.
In my mind, it sounds incredible.
Yeah.
But we just got to get it. We just got to get there, you know?
Yeah, man. I hope you do. I hope you come out to the East Coast. I want to check it out.
Yeah. I would love to.
Yeah, man. How much of moving to Austin do you contribute to being happier?
Oh, that's a great question. Not all of it, but certainly a good portion of it, because I moved to a place where it's a little bit cheaper to live. It's now not really a little bit cheaper. It's kind of expensive to live everywhere.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, I always come back to the price of a pound of butter. Buy a pound of butter in New York, four sticks of butter for like $6.50, I think. And that, like, you know, that that includes like trucking costs and paying tolls to get into Manhattan, which is a whole thing.
Yeah.
Pound of butter in Texas is like $3.50. And so when you take all of those little things that you didn't realize were like eating away at your finances and making you miserable because you're poor and you can't do anything or go anywhere. I'm not poor now, but I'm certainly like not sweating money. Like I was sweating money every damn day in New York City, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, certainly moving to Austin, and I was born and raised in Florida, which is the Sunshine State.
Yeah.
And I just do not have those long, dark, short days, winters in me. That those were my darkest periods, were when the sun was would go away in New York and it was just like snowing all the time and disgusting outside. And
yeah, I've lived in Maryland my whole life and I'm starting to get tired of winter.
Yeah.
It's the worst. It's, man.
You know, the heat is a whole other thing, but you can always take clothes off is the way I've always looked at it. Like the thing about the winter was that it would become physically painful to step outside.
Yeah.
And as hot as it gets outside, it is never like physically painful to, like on your skin to just like step into the sun for a moment. It's like, wow, it's really hot. I got to get out of the sun, but it's not painful yet.
Mm-hmm.
Wintertime in the Northeast, my God, man, you like step out of the apartment and it's already like your face is being shredded by the wind. And yeah, it's
brutal, dude.
It's no good. Mm-hmm. And especially if you are inclined toward moodiness, like I've been my entire life, it can just exacerbate that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Yeah. I think, I'm getting back into doing the podcast with this interview. I think I skipped one or two months just because of the general malaise of winter. It's just a bummer. You get tired of it.
Yeah, it's a total bummer.
But yeah, man. Thanks for doing this.
And my pleasure. I hope that I make an interesting subject. You know, I don't really do a lot of interviews myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this really isn't an interview show. It might turn into that. Usually what we do is we pick a one-word topic and me, my co-host, and a guest will pick three songs around that topic and just play the songs and talk about them. But yeah, like I said, I've just kind of taken a back seat in the winter, and now I'm just kind of trying to get myself interested in it again. And by the way I'm doing that is talking to interesting people. And yeah, man, I really liked your album. I don't know why. I think it was really seeing the album cover on Instagram, and I was like, you know what? That's striking. I haven't seen that in a long time. Like, that's just, I haven't seen a good album cover in a while. I'll check it
Hell
out.
Hell yeah. I really appreciate that. That I will just say as a last little note here, that is my first appearance on my own album cover.
Okay.
I think so that's the third Guma album I put out. Three or four records in the last band that I was in. I've never stepped in front of the camera or in front of the music rather until now. And there's a whole realm of psychology wrapped up in those decisions as well. But
absolutely.
I'm glad to hear it was a striking image for you because it was time. It was another thing that Schlarb was kind of pushing me on. Like, A, are you going to name the album?
Yeah.
And B, are you going to actually step out in front of the music and like and be the front person that you claim to be?
Yeah, man. Yeah, good for him. Are you going to be on the next cover? Is this going to be
a thing?
I probably
should be.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do it, man. You are Guma.
I am Guma.
And you are TJ Masters. And like I said, thanks for doing this. Everybody check out Co-op Radio. Or what is it? Co-op.org?
Online. Yeah, K-O-O-P.org. It's funny when I say, like, even in Austin, when I say, like, oh, I'm with Co-op, people are like, which co-op?
Right.
Like, which cooperative are you with? Right. We just get so used to saying co-op, but yeah, the call sign is K-O-O-P.
And I keep wanting to call it Coop.
WFMU or whatever.
Yeah.
Coop. Yeah. Coop is looked down upon within the organization.
Okay. I won't say that.
But yeah, koop.org, coop.org.
Yeah.
You can stream it online there. You can check out the show Small Cool World every Thursday at 4:30 Central Time.
Yeah. I recommend it.
Thank you.
Just because of what we talked about earlier in the interview, just stuff you're not going to hear every day. And it's, all of it's good, honestly. So we've got A List of Sightings is the latest record that's out. But all your stuff is pretty much wherever you can stream music, right? Apple Music, Spotify.
That's correct.
All that, all your Guma records. Yep. What other bands were you in before Guma?
The band that I fronted in New York City was called Conveyor. Mm-hmm. And we put out three records, more like two records and a movie soundtrack, but three records and a couple of EPs. Toured the country with that group, got some nice mentions in some nice places press wise and then just to draw a little through line for you here, I was kind of planning my exit from New York City, knowing that that band was winding down and members of that band were pursuing other opportunities professionally, moving into graduate degrees and this kind of thing. Sure. But I was still like writing songs for them and was feeling so conflicted about like wanting to work on new material while the people who were close to me were peeling away from me. And that's about the time that one of those guys said, oh, Guma, that would make a really good band name. And so I took those tunes and I made the first Guma record with them.
Awesome, man.
And I learned a very important lesson in the modern age, which is don't change your band name in the middle of your career. I had this rosy idea that like all of the fans that Conveyor had accumulated would like naturally follow me to Guma and just get the point.
Yeah.
And that first Guma album landed like a wet brick, just like nothing. And it's taken me a long time to kind of rebuild an interest and a following, even though I was pushing it on all those old social media channels and all that bullshit.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyone who takes an interest in or took an interest in Conveyor, I would hope would love Guma because it's the same guy.
Okay. I'm not really familiar with Conveyor. Were you the singer in that
singer
band
songwriter?
Well?
Yep.
Okay, so yep. It's not that big of a leap to Guma, but I would imagine Conveyor had its own sound. Guma, every song is its own masterpiece.
Right? Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a difference there, but dude, you're progressing, and it sounds good, man. Anything else you want to promote?
I'm very occasionally on YouTube, talking about motorcycles.
Oh yeah.
I have a little channel going, which has some Guma videos on there. There's some, live performances. There's some unreleased songs and there's also motorcycle maintenance, which is a hobby of mine that I'm really passionate about. And I started making videos because I was working on these vintage bikes that don't really have a lot of modern documentation. You can download like PDFs of shop manuals from the 80s that have like somebody's greasy fingerprints on the scans.
Uh-huh.
You can chat with old timers on forums and whatnot, but there wasn't really a modern visual educational component to the specific bike that I was working on, and so I just made one myself.
Which is
and
what?
Honestly, I have two Hondas. One of them is a 1970 and one is a 1980. And the 1980 is a 750cc engine. And that's just not a very popular model of bike. So there wasn't a lot of stuff on it online. Mm-hmm. So I made a video that is just like, here are some basic maintenance procedures that are specific to this bike. And honestly, Kevin, those videos have more views and comments than any of the Guma
any
stuff.
Any of your music stuff?
But it's something like I'm really passionate about.
Yeah.
Educating and showing. I love showing people how to do things that they don't know how to do or didn't think they were capable of doing. I do it at the radio station. Mm-hmm. I do it with the motorcycles. And hopefully I do it with songwriting as well. I hope that people get inspired to do their own stuff when they listen to Guma.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. Yeah, I need to start writing again. So you've inspired right? me. What? What's the? Are they both the same model, the Hondas?
The 70 is a CL350, so it's a little twin engine, two cylinders, and it's got I don't know how much you know about motorcycles, but
not much.
It's got the exhaust like sweeps up high on the side because it was originally meant to be a scrambler or like something that you would go like off-roading in.
Yeah.
It's heavy as shit and it's 55 years old, so you probably shouldn't take it off-roading, but but that one's a 350 and the 1980 is a 750, which is a bit of a beefier bike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My dad had a, I don't know if it was a 750. What would be below that? Like a 500?
Yeah, they had a CB550 and a CB500.
That's what it was. A CB, yeah, 500, I think. Yeah, it was sparkle green gas tank with the black line on it that looked like a road. It was a cool fucking bike, man.
But I love those old Hondas. Can't get enough of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, last plug. You can find me on YouTube standing amongst my bikes talking about different grades of motor oil, things like that.
What is the channel?
Guma Mug.
Okay.
Which is like GUMAMUG.
Forward and backward, a palindrome.
Forward and backward, yeah. And that's my social media handles and all that as well. Guma Mug on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay, so all the bike heads should search that on YouTube.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thanks a lot, dude.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, man. Like I said, I hope you tour. Love to see you live. And maybe I'll make it out to Austin. I need to check out BLK Vinyl. And,
yeah, please let me know if you do, because I will swing by to make your acquaintance and pick up some great records at the same time.
Absolutely, man. Cool, man. Thanks a lot. And I'll see you later.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Angles only we achieve.